Chapter 31. Washington, D.C. Angelo Donatelli was surprisingly easy to trace. Austin simply looked up his name on the Internet and found 15 references, including a Business Week article that described the rags-to-riches rise from lowly cocktail lounge waiter to owner of one of New York's more fashionable restaurants. The picture of Donatelli conferring with his head chef showed a silver-haired and middle-aged man who looked more like a distinguished European diplomat than a restaurateur. Austin called directory assistance in Manhattan, and a minute later he was talking to the restaurant's friendly assistant manager.
"Mr. Donatelli is not in today," she said.
"When is the best time to get him?"
"He's due back from Nantucket tomorrow. You can try calling here after 3 p.m.
Nantucket. Austin knew the island off the Massachusetts coast well, having stopped there several times while sailing to Maine. He tried to get a Nantucket phone number for Donatelli. It was unlisted. A few minutes later, he was talking to a Lieutenant Coffin at the Nantucket Police Department. Austin identified himself as being with NUMA and said he wanted to get in touch with Angelo Donatelli. He was banking on the fact that small-town police know everything and everybody in their community. The police officer confirmed that Donatelli had a summer home on the island, but he was wary.
"What's the National Underwater and Marine Agency want with Mr. Donatelli?"
"We're pulling together some historic stuff on collisions at sea. Mr. Donatelli was aboard the Andrea Doria when it was hit."
"I've heard that. Met him a couple of times. Nice guy."
"I've tried calling him, but his number is unlisted."
"Yeah, most of the people out where he lives kind of like it that way. They built those big houses so they can have their privacy."
"I may try to get a flight to the island later today and take my chances on hooking up with him."
"Tell you what, when you get on island, drop by the police station on Water Street and ask for me. I can show you where he lives on a map."
Good cop, Austin thought. He wasn't about to dispense information on one of the island's well-to-do property owners without checking Austin out in person. Austin never dreamed Nina would track down a lead so quickly. With Zavala in Texas and Trout in the Yucatan, maybe Austin could squeeze in a quick interview with Donatelli. He used his government clout to get a seat with a small commuter airline that ran regular shuttles between Washington and Nantucket. A couple of hours later, he was on a puddle jumper flying northeast. The flight gave him time to look over the file Yeager had dropped on his desk as Austin was leaving his NUMA office. Austin had asked the computer whiz to scour his electronic marvels for information on the Brotherhood, the 16th-century secret society he and Perlmutter had discussed over lunch, and to run down any links Los Hermanos might have had to Christopher Columbus. Austin glanced out the window at the ocean sparkling far below, then opened the file and read Yeager's note.
"Hi, Kurt. I think I've got it. I've been wading through secret societies up to my eyeballs, but the Columbus angle narrowed it down. I followed up one of those stray facts that go floating across your monitor screen from obscure sources. A one-sentence footnote that Columbus was said to be associated with an outfit called the Brotherhood of the Holy Sword of Truth." They liked long titles back then. "Can't confirm if he was a member. Probably not. The Brotherhood was formed in the 1400s during the Spanish Inquisition by an archdeacon named Hernando Perez, head of a powerful monastery known for its extreme beliefs, heavily into self-flagellation and hair shirts. Perez was slightly to the right of Torquemada, who was the head honcho of the Inquisition. Perez picked the most fanatical of his followers from his monastery. The brothers made up the trusted core of his outfit. Perez was mad as a hatter, unswerving in his convictions, quite happy to use violence and murder to achieve his ends. He declared absolution for his guys, no matter how much blood they shed for his cause, which was to wipe out heretics.
And get rich doing it, by the way. They split loot plundered from their victims with the Inquisition. The Brotherhood worked behind the scenes, identifying the unfaithful so they could be fed into the Inquisition's murder machine. Sometimes it sent out its own hit squads. Or, for a price, it might see that you were spared, as long as they could bleed you of money. Heresy covered a lot of ground, which brings in another angle. Back then, you could be burned at the stake for saying Columbus discovered America. The scriptures never said anything about the American continents. It messes with the whole idea of Adam and Eve. So when Columbus claimed that he reached India or China, the powers that be backed him up. The real reasons were political, though. Church and state were the same thing. When somebody questioned church dogma, it threatened the throne. Once doubts set in about the church's teachings on geography, the hoi polloi might start asking why they were starving and the bishops and kings were all well fed. And before long, the mobs would be marching on the palace. Millions were at stake as well. Spain wanted the riches of the New World to herself. If other countries could prove Columbus wasn't the first to discover India, rivals of Spain like Portugal might claim the new lands and riches. Gold meant new warships and raising armies, so we're really talking about European domination. That's why the Inquisition, which was the terror instrument of the Spanish state, made it heresy, punishable by burning, to believe there was a continent with separate civilizations and that they had contact with the Old World before Columbus. To show you how dangerous the idea was, Amerigo Vespucci was sent on a secret mission by the king to check out the Columbus discoveries. When Vespucci demonstrated Columbus had not discovered a short route to India, that he'd found a new continent and may not have been the first to go there, he was called a heretic and warned to recant. By making this a capital crime, the Spanish were admitting tacitly that there had indeed been prior contact. Torquemada was a sly old devil. He said that even if the Indians had received a visitor from the West, whom they named Quetzalcoatl, the stranger must have been white and Spanish. That meant Spain had dibs on the new lands even before Columbus was born. I verified that 5 sailors died after eating at Columbus's house. Can't prove the Brotherhood had anything to do with it. Could have been food poisoning. I couldn't find anything on the Brotherhood after the 1600s. Maybe they went out of business with the Inquisition. Source material enclosed. Hope this helps. The rest of the file contained source documents. Austin read through the pile of papers and decided the computer genius had done a good job encapsulating his findings. The account of the Brotherhood was fascinating, particularly in its mission to suppress knowledge of contact between the new and the old worlds. One problem: the Brotherhood went out of business more than 300 years ago. The pilot's voice announced that the plane was passing near Martha's Vineyard. Nantucket's pork chop shape was visible to the east of the vineyard. An ocean fog nibbled at the windswept moors and long white strands that edged the island. It was easy to see why the island attracted the peg-legged Captain Ahab and real-life Quaker whaling captains and shipowners who made their fortunes in the whaling trade. Nantucket had at its doorstep a saltwater highway that would take its whaling vessels to all the 7 seas on voyages that often lasted years. Austin rented a car at Tom Nevers Airport and drove into town, past stately brick houses built with riches made from whale oil, the car bumping over the wide main street that was paved with cobblestones once used for ballast in the old sailing ships, then along Water Street bordering the harbor until he came to the police and fire station. Lieutenant Coffin was a tall string bean of a man with high cheekbones and a prominent bony nose that had seen too much sun. His mouth dropped open in surprise when Austin identified himself. "You got here in a hurry," he said, sizing up the husky man with the prematurely white hair. "You Numa guys have private jets?" "Some of us do. I lucked out in catching a flight. It was a good excuse to get out of Washington." "Can't blame you for that. The island's awfully pretty this time of year."
You're missing the crowds, too.
The hazel eyes narrowed.
Just so you'll know, I called Numa back after I talked to you.
Can't blame you for that.
Coffin smiled.
Seems like you're on the up and up. We're pretty easygoing, but we can't be too careful. Nantucket's got a lot of rich folks who own big houses and pay major taxes. Don't see a burglar asking the police where the house is he plans to rob, but you never know. Good thing you called. People out there kind of look after each other. They'd give you directions to the other side of the island. I'll show you how to get to his house.
He slid a tourist map across the counter.
Take the Pulpus Road till you get to a sand driveway with a ship on the mailbox.
Coffin drew the route with a yellow marker. Austin thanked the police officer and followed his directions out of town to a narrow, winding road that ran through scrub pine forest and past farms and cranberry bogs. At the mailbox, which was surmounted by a metal rendering of a black-and-white ocean liner, Austin turned onto the sand road and drove through stunted forest that turned into rolling heathland. The strong smell of the sea was carried on the ropey tendrils of fog he had seen from the air. The big house loomed suddenly from the fog. It looked deserted. No vehicles outside, no lights in the windows, even though darkness was falling. Austin left the car in the horseshoe-shaped, crushed-shell driveway, followed a walkway bordered by an expansive and well-manicured lawn to the wide open porch, and rang the front doorbell. Chimes echoed inside. No answer. Maybe the restaurant manager had it wrong. Or perhaps Donatelli changed his plans and went back to New York earlier than expected. Austin frowned. This could be a time-wasting wild goose chase. He'd known from the start that he was grasping at a straw, trying to connect a robbery at sea decades before with the killings of archaeologists. He wondered if he could catch a flight back to D.C. Oh, hell, he'd get home just as fast if he stayed the night and flew out first thing in the morning. With his decision made, Austin decided to explore the grounds. He left the veranda and walked around the house. Nantucket had become afflicted with a plague of trophy houses, so big they looked like small hotels, built by wealthy people who saw square footage as a way of one-upping their neighbors. Donatelli's place was large, and the builder had managed to incorporate Italianate architectural features in with the more traditional silver-gray shingles and white trim. But it was all done in good taste. Behind the house was a fair-sized vegetable garden and a children's swing and slide set. Austin followed the sound of the breaking surf across a wide lawn to the edge of a sandy cliff and stood for a moment at the top of a weather-beaten stairway that led down to the beach. The beach was obscured and ocean sound muffled by the fog, but he could hear distant rollers slapping against the shore. He turned and looked back at the house. In the fog and waning light, he could barely see the place. Figuring he had done all he could, Austin returned to the car and wrote a note that included his telephone number, asking Donatelli to call him as soon as possible. He trudged back to the front door. Low-tech communication, but it might work. He would follow it up with a phone call when he got back to his office. He climbed onto the broad porch and tucked the rolled-up note under the ornate door knocker, thinking the brass weight would keep the paper from blowing away. He realized he had more important things than the wind to worry about. Hard, cold metal pressed against the back of his neck. Then came the unmistakable click of a very large gun being cocked. Until then, there had been no sound, not even a footfall.
"Hands up!" a harsh voice said. "Don't turn around."
The man spoke with an accent. Austin slowly lifted his hands.
"Mr. Donatelli?" "Don't talk," the man said, emphasizing his order with a hard jab to the neck.
A practiced hand frisked Austin, deftly slipping his wallet out of his pocket. Satisfied Austin carried no weapon, The man ordered him to climb the outside stairs leading from the porch to a second-story deck that wrapped around three sides of the house. The fog had closed in with a vengeance, and in the dimming light Austin would not have seen the figure leaning against a railing if his attention had not been caught by the orange glow of a cigarette and the smell of strong tobacco.
"Sit," said the man with the gun.
Austin did as he was told, plunking into a deck chair that was damp with moisture. Keeping his gun leveled at Austin, the man spoke in Italian to the smoker. They conferred for a minute. The figure in the fog spoke.
"Who are you?"
"My name is Kurt Austin, and I'm with the National Underwater and Marine Agency."
Pause. "You're consistent, anyhow. That's the same story you gave Lieutenant Coffin."
The voice had an accent, but it wasn't as thick as that of the gun carrier.
"You talked to Coffin?"
"Of course. The police try to keep their summer residents happy, especially those who are big contributors to their equipment fund. I've requested that he let me know if anyone ever asks for me. He even offered to come out here with you. I told him I could handle the situation by myself."
"Then you are Mr. Donatelli?"
"I ask the questions." Another sharp jab in the spine.
"Who are you really?"
"My wallet has identification."
"Identification can be forged."
Donatelli was going to be a tough sell. "Lieutenant Coffin called Numa and verified that I am who I said I am."
"I have no doubt you are who you claim. It's what you really are that interests me."
Austin's patience was eroding. "Make believe I don't understand what you're talking about, Mr. Donatelli. Why would a big government agency like Numa want to talk to me? I run a restaurant in New York. The only thing I have to do with the ocean is the seafood I buy from Fulton Fish Market."
"Reasonable question. You were on the Andrea Doria."
"Lieutenant Coffin said you mentioned the Doria. That's old news, isn't it?" "We were hoping you might have some information bearing on a case we're working on." "Tell me about this case, Mr. Austin. You may put your hands down, but remember that my cousin Antonio is from Sicily, and, like most Sicilians, he trusts nobody. He is quite good with the Lupara, especially at close range." Lupara was the sawed-off shotgun that used to be the choice of the Sicilian mafia before they went to automatic weapons and car bombs. An antique, but still deadly.
"Before I start," Austin said evenly, "I'd appreciate it if you told Cousin Tony that if he doesn't stop sticking me in the neck, his Lupara is going to end up where the sun don't shine."
Austin had no way to carry out his threat, but it had been a long day and he was tired of getting jabbed. Donatelli translated for the gunman. Antonio stepped away and stood off to one side, the gun still leveled at Austin. A slit that could have been a mouth opened into what might have been a smile. A cigarette lighter flared in the darkness, showing Donatelli's deep-set eyes.
"Now tell us your story, Mr. Austin."
So he did. "The whole thing started in Morocco," Austin began. From there he worked his way to the present, explaining how the trail had led to Donatelli. "One of our researchers came across your name in a newspaper article. When I read that you had seen an armored truck robbery on the ship, I wanted to talk to you." Donatelli was silent for a moment, then he spoke in Italian to his cousin. The stocky figure who'd been standing next to Austin moved silently through the sliders, and a second later a light came on inside the house.
"Let us go inside and be comfortable, Mr. Austin. It's damp out here. Bad for the bones."
"I must apologize. I thought you were one of them." "They would never bother to concoct such a fantastic story, so it must be true." Austin stepped inside. Donatelli gestured to a plush chair next to the large fireplace.
eased into an opposite chair, and clicked a remote control. A gas fire huffed on in the hearth. The heat penetrating the glass screen felt good. Austin was covered with moisture that had nothing to do with the dew point. His eyes rose to the mantle and rested on a minutely detailed scale model of the Andrea Doria. The model was only part of the collection of memorabilia, photos, and paintings, even a flotation device that was sprinkled around the spacious living room, all having to do with the Doria. Donatelli was studying him. The flickering light from the fireplace bathed the still handsome features of a man in his 60s. The thick head of wavy hair, combed straight back, was grayer than it appeared in the business magazine photo. In general, Donatelli had aged well. He was still trim, and in the expensive-looking pale blue running suit and New Balance running shoes, he looked as if he worked at keeping fit. Cousin Antonio was the exact opposite. He was short and squat, with a shaved head and watchful eyes set in a face that looked as if it had been used for a punching bag. The nose was broken, the ears cauliflowered, and the sallow skin covered with a lacework of scars. He was dressed in a black shirt and black slacks. He had reappeared carrying a tray with two brandy glasses and Austin's wallet on it. The waiter image was diminished somehow by the shotgun strapped onto his shoulder. "Grappa," Donatelli said, "it will burn the dampness from our bones." Austin tucked the billfold back into his pocket and tried the liquor. The Italian fire water seared Austin's throat. It felt good. Donatelli took a sip and said, "How did you find me here, Mr. Austin? I left strict instructions with my office not to tell anyone where I was." "They said at the restaurant that you were on the island." The older man smiled. "So much for my security measures." Donatelli took another sip and stared silently into the fire. After a minute, he affixed Austin with his penetrating eyes. "It wasn't a robbery," he said flatly. "Did the newspaper get it wrong?" "I called it that for convenience. In a robbery, the thieves take something. These thieves took nothing except lives." With a sharp memory for detail and touches of humor, Donatelli related the events of that memorable night in 1956. Even after all these years, his voice trembled during his description of the shifting of the dying ship as he made his way deeper in the flooded darkness. He told about the murder of the armored truck guards, his flight, and his eventual rescue. "You said the truck carried a stone," he mused. "Why would people kill over a stone, Mr. Austin?" "Maybe it's not just any stone." He shook his head, uncomprehending. "Mr. Donatelli, you said earlier that you thought I was one of them. What did you mean?" The restaurateur considered his words carefully. "In all the years since the ship went down, I have said nothing about what happened. The newspaper article was a slip of the tongue. I have known in my heart there was a reason for keeping this secret. After the article appeared, someone called and warned me never to say anything about that incident again. A man with a voice like ice. He knew everything about me and my family. My wife's hairdresser. The names of my children and grandchildren. Where they lived. He said if I ever mentioned that night to anyone, I would be killed. But first, I would see my family destroyed." He stared into the fire. "I come from Sicily. I believed him. I gave no more interviews. I asked Antonio to come and live with me. He was in difficulties with the authorities in his home, and was glad to relocate.
From the battered looks of Tony's face and the ease with which he handled his weapon, Austin had a good idea of what Tony's difficulties might have been, but he didn't pursue the matter.
"I assume the man who called didn't tell you his name, or who he was speaking for."
"Yes and no."
"That's right. No name. But he indicated that he was not acting alone, that he had many brothers."
"Brothers?"
"Could he have said brotherhood?"
"Yes. I think that's what he said."
"You've heard of them?"
"There was an organization called the Brotherhood of the Holy Sword of Truth. They worked with the Spanish Inquisition, but that was hundreds of years ago."
"The Mafia had its start hundreds of years ago," Donatelli replied with an amused glance at his cousin.
"Why is this different?"
"The Mafia's continued existence is pretty well established by its continuing activities."
"Yes, that is true, but even though people in the old country knew there was such a thing, and that the Black Hand had moved with the immigrants to America, the police here never knew about La Cosa Nostra until they found somebody, by accident, who would break the code of Muerto. Silence or death."
"You are saying that an organization might go on operating in secret for centuries?" Donatelli spread his hands. "The Mafia had murders, extortion, robbery. Yet the FBI director, Hoover, swore there was no such thing as La Cosa Nostra." As he pondered Donatelli's words, thinking he had a good point, Austin surveyed the room.
"You've come a long way since your waiter days," he said, taking in the luxurious wood paneling and brass fittings.
"I had help.
After the wreck, I decided I never wanted to set foot on a boat again." He chuckled.
"There is nothing like the unholy terror of being caught in the hold of a sinking ship to take the romance out of the sea. The woman I tried to help unfortunately died of her injuries. When I went to the funeral, her husband thanked me again and said he wanted to do something in return. I said it was my dream to have a small restaurant. He gave me seed money for a place in New York, on the condition that I take business and English courses, which he would also pay for. I named the restaurant Myra, after Mr. Carey's wife. I have opened 6 more restaurants in large cities across the country. They've made me a millionaire and allowed me to live like this. I married a wonderful woman. She gave me 4 sons and a daughter, all in the business, and many, many grandchildren." He sipped the last of his grappa and put the glass down on a table. "I built this house here for my family, but also I think because it is near to where the ship went down. On foggy nights like this it brings back memories. You see, Mr. Austin, the accident was bad for many people, like Mr. Carey. But it changed my life for the better."
"Why are you telling me this now? You could have just sent me on my way."
"My wife died last year. After I survived the Andrea Doria, I thought I would live forever. I saw in her death a reminder that I am mortal like all men. I am not a religious man, but I began to think more about making things right. Those men who were killed in the ship's hold, maybe the others you told me of, they need somebody to speak for them." His jaw hardened. "I will be the spokesman for the dead."
Donatelli looked at the wall clock.
"It is getting late, Mr. Austin. Do you have a place to stay?"
"I thought I'd get a room at a bed and breakfast."
"Not necessary. You will have your bed here tonight as my guest, and breakfast tomorrow. For dinner I will prepare a special pasta, tomatoes and zucchini fresh from the garden."
An invitation like that would be impossible to refuse.
"Good."
He poured them more grappa and hoisted his glass high. "Then, when we have eaten and drunk our wine,
We will find a way to show these people what it means to mess with a Sicilian.